Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is
me. A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my
onto
friend?
A Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk.
Good morning. This is Tech Talk, and it's Michael Tech Talk Kassler. And it's going to be an interesting day today here in the area. Not only we got me coming on, so that's always interesting, right? Tech Talk coming at you. We got Jay Garman going to be with you in just a few minutes. And then anybody that's actually in the area, be aware. I know Rusty was talking about this a little bit earlier. A little bit of white stuff maybe coming to your way, especially later this evening. The estimates, they're just going, it's going crazy. It's up, it's down, it's around the corner. Who knows? Anywhere between 4 to 8 inches, depending on where you are in the northern Chicago to southern Chicago, northern Indiana area, all the way up into southern Wisconsin. So we'll see how that all shakes out by the end of the day. But just a fair warning, please do be careful as you're driving around. It's going to be one of those things. We got some great stuff coming up today. I'm going to give you a little teaser about the next 2 weeks, too. We got great, great, cool stuff happening the next 2 weeks. Next week, we're going to have our good friend Joe Otto is going to be on again from Verizon. He's going to talk to us. You know what? I have got the coolest. I love this. Can't wait to talk to Joe about it. Samsung Galaxy Note 4, very, very cool piece of tech. I've got to ask Joe, though, what is the stylus for? Tell me how to use my stylus. It comes with a little pen. I don't know if you've seen this. It's a little pen that you can write on with it. I'm having a blast with it, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe I don't do enough handwriting stuff that it's important, but I know that Joe's going to give me some ideas and some thoughts about it, and we'll talk about that next week. The week following that, I'm really excited about this, though, too. I don't know if you've heard, but the FCC is very, very close to starting to make some real decisions about what they're going to do on net neutrality. And so when that comes and that happens, we're gonna have some really big news, and this is coming in February, hopefully. Now I know a little bit about it. I know what's going on a little bit, but I thought it would be a great idea if we could bring in somebody who knows a lot about it. So we're gonna have our good friend John Miley is gonna come back. He's an expert researcher from Kiplinger, and he's gonna come on and give us his opinions, his insight, and his information about what we can expect in the coming months and years, if and when these new regulations roll out from the FCC. So that'll be cool. So as I said, just a little bit of a teaser for you over the next 2 weeks. We're going to have Jay Garman on in just a little bit. But first, before we do that, I'm actually going to hit just a couple of quick news and notes and things that are going on. I already mentioned the FCC stuff. Yeah, that's this month, this February. They're going to be doing it. John Wheeler is the head of the FCC, is a chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, and he is going to try to answer the question as to just whose internet is it anyways. And this is going to be really the biggest regulatory shakeup to the telecommunications industry that we've seen since some of the divestiture of the cable company infrastructure and things like that, which was back in 96. Now, Tom Wheeler has been extremely close to the chest with the information and the things that he is considering. So we'll see what happens with that. He has said, though, that he wants, and this is his statement here. These are quotes, a quote from Tom Wheeler. Says he wants yardsticks in place to determine what is in the best interest of consumers as opposed to what is in the best interest of the gatekeepers. Now, that's giving a lot of net neutrality proponents a lot of heart and some good confidence that Mr. Wheeler is going to really be focused on reining in what many see as the abuses of these cable companies, these companies that are and these internet provider companies that are actually providing the access to our internet. Now, an interesting side point to this. So, of course, you know, part of the bigger discussion surrounding this is how important bandwidth, internet access, and everything else has become to us, not only as individuals, but in our corporations and in our schools. And the FCC, who is also too invested in the USAC, which is the United States, it's an organization which provides funding and monies to school districts to support technology, primarily through the E-Rate program. Now, the E-Rate program, over the many years that it's been in existence, has distributed literally billions of dollars. You pay for the E-Rate program out of your cell bills. By the way, you may not realize that, but one of the little charges that comes out is a couple of pennies that goes straight into this fund to increase and enhance some of the infrastructure needs of school districts across the country, particularly those in rural areas or in low-income areas. It's based, the amount of funding you can get is based on the number or the percentage of free and reduced children in your schools. They're making changes to that. In fact, they just have. They've come out with some major changes to it, which are going to impact how your local school district can get money. One of the bigger changes is they have taken away the money that previously had gone to supporting telephony. In the past, you could have money paid to your school district in order to put in the phone systems or to pay for phone systems that were not on premise. Anyways, wording of it was such that you could not pay for the phones themselves, but the phone service you could. Same thing with your, of course, internet service was also included in some of that same language. That's going away. The reason why is they want to focus money less on voice communications and somewhat old school telephony stuff, and they're really putting money now into high speed broadband. So there's gonna be a lot more money available for your broadband, and also too, and this is new, this is brand new, this is going to impact a lot of districts, they're putting money into Wi-Fi. That means your local stuff. That means the stuff that goes on inside the walls that had not been available before. They're also increasing the amount of money that's available for schools and school districts. And this is an interesting, this is a rather contentious point that they're doing another change, is that they're changing the way that they're calculating for a school how much money they should get in order to help pay for this. In the past, it was done on a school-by-school basis, building-by-building. They're changing that now. They're going to force the districts to average it throughout the district so that they get a consistent percentage. This is supposed to make things much easier, of course, on a calculation basis, but some schools and districts are complaining because, of course, there's always going to be a loser. You know, someone's going to be a loser in any of these things. Overall, I have to say, and I, as you know, if you listen at all to the show, I'm pretty involved in technology and education and the financing of it and things like that. And I have to say, overall, I'm relatively pleased with the changes that they've made. I haven't gotten deep into the fine print of it, but I think that the things that they're doing are generally good things, and that these are focusing and refocusing the dollars in the right places. It's making more money available where it should be. And one of the bigger changes that they're making, which I'm if I was filing for E-Rate, this would be music to my ears. Anybody out there that actually has to deal with this, listen to this. You can do it online. Yes, that's right. They're making so much more of it available online. None of those stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks of papers. That's right. You can do it online. So it's cool stuff. It's good things. The FCC seems to be making some good changes as well as the USAC. So good stuff. I forgot too. I was going to mention that we've got, as I said, a lot of stuff going on with that, with the FCC, with net neutrality. And of course, this gets people heated up. You know, people get excited about it. They get angry about it. Maybe they get a little upset, you know, for one thing or another. Maybe it's not this. Maybe it's, people with measles, you know, in Disneyland and not getting vaccinated. You get mad about that. You go on Twitter and you start screaming at people. It turns out, although it's maybe not as dangerous for you as not getting vaccinated, being angry on Twitter is pretty bad for you too. It may feel good. You know, you get on there and you just cut loose. But researchers at the University of Pennsylvania recently found a very strong correlation between the use of negative language on Twitter and other social networks and heart disease mortality. And this was looking specifically at tweets made publicly between 2009 and 2010. And they found that communities where expletives and hate words were tweeted the highest often also had the highest rates of heart disease deaths. Positive tweets, though, showed exactly the opposite effect. So go out there and be happy. Don't be a Debbie Downer. Go and tweet happiness. That's what you need to do. It's not only good for the people you tweet to, but you know, it's good for your heart. Good for your heart. So have a good heart and tweet heart healthy stuff. I think that's what it comes down to. Oh man. Never a dull moment when you're on the Twitter. That's what I say. Now we use Twitter here fairly often. I'm going to mention to people that if you go to twitter.com/techtalkWRLR, you can follow us right now, and we always keep updates not only on what we're doing with the show, but also to any kind of news that we run across and other information. We like to keep posting it up through there, and of course you'll be the first one to know when the podcasts are released. You can go to techtalkwrlr.com, get any of those podcasts, but if you're not following us on Twitter or facebook.com/techtalkwrlr, you'll get a notice there too. So speaking of things that get people worked up, angry, maybe a little crazy, and I'm going to talk to Jay about this. I know, because he is a big fan, as am I, of the oatmeal. The oatmeal is coming out with a new card game. What do you think of this? Exploding Kittens, the card game. It's a card game for people who are into both kittens and explosions. Oh, and also laser beams and sometimes goats. So it looks like a lot of fun. It's kind of like a Russian roulette with cards, but instead of a gun, you might get an exploding kitten. And the reason I bring this up is because they just hit 100,000 backers. They are the most funded Kickstarter game, Kickstarter funded anything ever at any time. It's just the most backed Kickstarter project ever. They're over 100,000. They're over right around 110,000 backers right now. They've raised more than $4 million online. And yeah, that's right. This is for a card game. Matthew Inman, the artist behind the oatmeal, apparently he found that sweet spot, so he's hitting that, and which is very, very cool. I haven't kicked into it. I've thought about it. It's it's not a lot of money, and you're guaranteed to get a card game. Now he's certainly funded enough, so it's one way that you could go and do that. I'm gonna do one last quick little news bit here before trying to get Jay on just even a little bit early here today. This is, we were talking about Verizon earlier, and I love Verizon. They're doing good stuff, and they've certainly been great for our show here. But they've been in a little bit of hot water lately, in that they have what's called a super cookie or a zombie cookie issue. It's related to a unique identifier header. It's referred to as a UIDH. And what that is it's a little ID. You may not realize this. When you're on the internet on your phone, you've got cookies on there too, just like you do on your computer. And you need to worry about it or be concerned about privacy when you're using your computer, your laptop, your desktop, but you also have to worry about it when you're using your cell phone. Now, it turns out the Verizon has, like many companies, has had a little UIDH, which is a record tracker, basically, that says where you've gone, what you've done, what type of activity you've used the internet through their cell phone for. And you can... we're supposed to be able to, not have that track you, but it turns out that the ways that you could stop it were not really working. And Verizon was using that, of course, for targeted advertising. This is where people get kind of antsy in the pants about it, is that I don't want people figuring out what I'm doing so that they can sell me stuff. You know, I don't know why. Dave and I have had this debate many times. I don't have an issue with this. Many, many, many people do, though. But so because of those people now, Verizon is backing off from its stance that the UIDH is going to stay in place. They've actually now set up a system so that you can opt out. If you want to go through the process, you can go in, you can opt out of that UIDH. It will not track you anymore. It's going to be available soon. It's not there yet, but keep an eye on it if you're concerned about this, and you can do it. Now, it actually has been used inappropriately because there was a way to kind of hack this information, even if it wasn't from Verizon. There was a company called Turn, and they were using what they called these zombie cookies on Verizon customers, and they would auction off access to your phone, believe it or not, to advertisers. And based upon how the auction went, which could happen in milliseconds, then an ad would be targeted to you, would come up on your phone and on your screen once you loaded a web page. And I mean, it's crazy. And according to Turn, they actually receive, get this, they receive 2 million requests for advertisements. Not per week, not per day. No. 2 million requests for advertisements per second. So you think about the kind of money that's turning and churning through this and all related to trying to get you to buy something. That is a little scary, I guess. Just the scale of it is a bit insane. And hey, speaking of a little bit crazy, a little bit insane, I don't know if Jay would like that reference, but I'll make it anyways. We're going to give Jay a call, see if we can bring him on here. Now, Jay, as you know, he's a little bit further south than us. I don't think he's got to worry about the snow today, so hopefully we won't have any troubles.
Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Garmin. How you doing, sir?
Not too bad. Yourself?
Not bad. We're digging in here. We're getting ready for, you know, they got to come up with some new names. I just keep seeing Snowmageddon come up. I guess it's so... you know, it's just so pithy. It rolls off the tongue. People haven't come up with something better.
I'm a fan of Snowpocalypse myself.
I do like Snowpocalypse better. That's a nice alternative. I don't know. I don't know what would satisfy me, but it's just going to snow. It really. And they're talking about up to possibly even 8 inches, 8 to 10 inches. It seems though lately, I don't know if you've noticed this, but there just seems to have been a lot of hyperbole in our weather. Predictions. You know, the East Coast non-event, you know, at least not as bad as it said that was going to be. And that's happened a few times this year. So I'm kind of crossing fingers it won't be quite as bad as we're expecting.
Well, one, they always get ratings, you know, when they promise impending disaster. And two, there have been times in the past 2 or 3 years where they've not taken it seriously, and it's gotten rough. Like a couple of years ago, you know, Atlanta got that unexpected ice storm, and there were kids who spent the night in schools because they didn't cancel school, and then they couldn't get home.
You know, that is a good point. That is true. Now, we haven't gotten so far that we're jailing people who or suing people for incorrect predictions like they did in Italy over the earthquake thing, but I guess there is that little bit of concern, a little bit of fear for that. So
unless it involves pasta, sports cars, or shoes, my general policy is I'm glad we don't do things the way Italy does.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I'd have to agree with that. Although there was some interesting stuff recently in the city of Corleone, which is, of course, you know, where the Godfather, they got the name for Don Corleone and Vito Corleone and so on, they're starting to break down the walls of Omerita, of the silence, and kind of crack into what's, you know, still the central hub of a mafia that really rules a lot of that area, you know, in a brutal manner. And I know it's way off the topic of of technology, but I find that just fascinating. You know, very interesting how these cultures can be created in certain spaces and really move along untouched by any other advances for a very long time. And maybe that's finally starting to come apart there.
Well, you know, to bring this back to something a bit more tough, it's all about, you know, engineered incentives. Like, what was the value to the government of going and getting rid of it? Because basically, I mean, the mafia, the people lived horribly. I mean, to a point, like, they're under basically a brutal warlord dictatorship in some ways. But it also took a lot off the government's hands.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
They didn't really have to do it. Like, they didn't have to go run Sicily.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, oh yeah. And you see the same thing happening, of course, all over the world. You know, I remember that was a shocking, not shocking, but certainly a meaningful moment for me when I got off the plane in São Paulo and we took the cab, and you go right by the favelas, people living in, you know, cardboard and metal shacks, and it just, you know, and you talk to people and it's like, oh yeah, no, nobody goes in there. That's its own world. It's its own country. And you're right. You know, what's the incentive to go in and try to make things better? Because first of all, you probably wouldn't. And and second, it's, yeah, there's just nothing good happening. So,
well, I am not by any means like a hardcore libertarian, but I do tend to like. Dennis Miller, the comedian, always has this great response to when people think there are government conspiracies out there. The government can't pave roads. Okay? So when you want to ascribe to the government capacities, like it was like fake a moon landing, just bear in mind they can't pave roads. But on the flip side of that, when you want the government to go fix something, bear in mind the government can't pave roads.
Exactly. There was a great meme that was jumping around too. It was about against the anti-GMO crowd who are saying, oh, you know, evil Monsanto is paying off everybody to for all these studies. And there was the chart showing, it's like, look, Monsanto makes less money than Starbucks. If anybody's got the resources to do some enormous conspiracy theory, pay off all of the researchers and et cetera, it's going to be Starbucks. Not, you know, it's like, yeah, yeah, okay.
It's gonna be Apple, okay? It's like, Apple has $170 billion in cash.
Yeah.
They could commission, and this is not a joke, they could commission and field and staff, not the whole carrier group, but more. We only have 11 Nimitz-class aircraft carriers in the United States Navy on active duty. They could build, staff, and run more aircraft carriers than the United States Navy if they wanted to spend that cash. They couldn't do 11 carrier groups with the literal ships and the escort destroyers and all that sort of thing, but they could put out more aircraft carriers than the United States Navy has in active service now if they got it in their head to do it.
So we could soon become the United States of Apple and never look back. Well,
have you been to a Starbucks recently?
Oh man. I have one Apple device. That's it. But they keep forcing it down my kids' throats too. Apple's done a great job with getting integrated into the school districts, of course. I've got one son in high school, one-to-one program there. Everybody's got an iPad. My other son in middle school now, he's getting part of that one-to-one program, an iPad and a Chromebook. So they're gonna have a little bit of both going on with that. I think the Chromebooks are going to be the true one-to-one, and then they're going to have iPad for special purpose instruction, which I think is a cool way to go about it. The Chromebooks are taking over, in fact, to a great degree. There was more Chromebooks bought for educational purposes last quarter. I don't have the information in front of me. I can't remember if it was last year or just last quarter. Then there were iPads, which is, of course, the first time that iPads and Apple products have been beaten out for pretty much anything. for a very, very long time. So that was kind of cool to see.
Yeah, I would recommend a Chromebook for a lot of people. The only reason I can't recommend it for everyone in my family is, first off, my parents just absolutely, like, they still have an AOL address. Like, I could not possibly explain to them cloud-based storage or using the browser. Like, it's a bridge too far.
Yeah.
And as far as my wife and my mother-in-law go, they still do a lot of, you know, social work, and so they have to do social work compliance, which means they have to file forms with the state, which are ineluctably and unavoidably Microsoft Word forms.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't mean like, you know, open them up in Word and add stuff and like you could then you just mail them. Like, no, like you physically have to work them in Word, save them as Word files, send them as Word files, and it all the fidelity has to say that. You can't even do Office 365, really. So it's got to be installed in MS Word, and there's just no getting around it.
Nah, yeah,
and
can't.
Like, we crack that nut, I can get them off these. I can get them so much cheaper computers.
Yeah, well, and you know, there have been some attempts at actual cloud desktop. Where what was it called? I think it was called like Cloud On, in fact. And I used it for a little while, and that was literally all that it had on it. You'd go on, and it was it looked like just you'd be like remote accessing into somebody's desktop, and you'd bring up Word or do whatever else you wanted to do. And of course, if you've got your documents stored in cloud storage, now you could take your Word document and put it in Google Drive, but not open it through that. Just download it and bring it up in Word. It would be a very complicated process for anybody right now. I think it's getting closer though. Google Drive recently has allowed now for native access to Microsoft Office documents, and of course I use Office 365 because we use that here at the radio station. And they just recently came out, in fact, now, and this is very cool, is the Outlook web access for businesses is now free and available on Android and iPhone and iPad. And it connects your email through Outlook, not only via the whole cloud interface, but also too, it really does a great job, in my opinion, of integrating the calendar with the email system, which had not been true with any other system that I've seen so far. So we'll get there. It's just taking time.
Right. Well, and I, as a guy who still writes for a not inconsiderable portion of his living, and have to, I need extremely fine-grained formatting controls for some of the work I do. And Google Docs cannot give that to me. Office 365 really can't give that to me. That's still one of the few things that remains the province of an installed app.
Yep.
Where I need extreme, you know, I'm the guy that knows the difference between a soft return and a hard return, and I know how to do advanced find replace on stuff for actual formatting content in documents. Like, you know, WordPad doesn't do it. Like, I'm not quite to you know, Quark or PageMaker or Publisher, but I'm one step below that, and I need that. And that, I completely concede there's absolutely no reason for that to be in Google Docs. I get why it's not there, because most people are not like me. God, is that true on so many levels.
Thank goodness, right? No.
I would appreciate it if there was some way for me to like get a Chrome extension or some sort of add-on pack for Google Docs that I could do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I would be extremely grateful, because that's the only thing keeping me from being Google Docs all the time.
Well, you know, you might want to look and check. They do have a lot of new Google Chrome, or not Chrome, but Google Docs and Drive add-ons, and they're coming out with more and more every day. If you go and you're opening up and you're looking at a document or a sheet, and you look at, I think it's tools and add-ins, and there's a ton of new add-ins. Some of them add additional fonts. I know with the sheets one, there's a lot of little cool kind of macro things like remove duplicates and things like this that are kind of difficult to do easily. It adds that. One thing with Office 365, there's so many things that you can do with it. The one thing that I just, we ran into this here at the station. I don't know why or what would prevent them from putting this in there, but it drives me absolutely crazy, is in the online version of Excel. And this is a huge hole for this, is you cannot set repeating rows. Which, if you're creating reports and things like this, what you want is you want those first couple rows, of course, to repeat on every page, or create a header on every page so that you don't have to figure out where the page break is and, you know, all that. You can't do it in Office 365. You have to use the desktop version. That just seems insane to me that is such a critical component of the software. But it's, so you're right. What I'm doing is I'm agreeing with you. You're absolutely right. It's really tough to get people over into that if they're doing any sort of you know, consistent document creation or advanced document creation. And the whole cloud thing, my wife is really just a bright lady, very on top of stuff in general. And I have had such a tough time, and she's had such a tough time sort of wrapping her head around how the cloud storage piece works and where her documents actually are. So I get it. It's tough. It's not for everybody yet.
No, it's not one. I think all these programs tend to fall down. The common theme I think we're stumbling on here is the engineers that make these programs don't have any concept of people who would ever want to take the content they created and either print it on paper or have to format it for publication in a different way. So, like, I write blog posts for a number of people, and there's a certain way you have to format text in order to convert it into a blog form, depending on what platform you are. You know, Blogger is different than WordPress, is different than TypePad, and there's different quirks to it. Or, God help you, if you're going to try and update a wiki document, you know, there's whole different, you know, markup and encoding you've got to do, and none of those systems are fault tolerant at all.
Yeah.
So, like, I know what the diacritical mark is for a non-breaking space. You know, like, you have to go find those, because that's how you get those weird, like, why is my headline on two lines when it shows?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't put NBSPs in there. Okay. Like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, or you forget the semicolon after that. Yeah, and that's becoming easier, though, too. You know, I think it was about a year ago we were speaking on air here with a guy who was doing a lot of work with Shakespeare, and he had created a number of online books around, and the first one that came out was Hamlet, and they just finished and produced a movie version of it, an indie movie on it. And but he and I spent a lot of time talking offline, because he was running into exactly what you're talking about. He was trying to take what he had created through on the web, which is really cool, hyperlinked text markup and all this stuff that if you didn't understand a word, you could click it and it would come up with a full definition, and trying to convert that into like a Kindle doc and something that would do exactly the same thing but on your Kindle or in iBooks. And very, very difficult to do. A lot of effort had to go into basically recreating everything he had done on the web. They're making that easier now. I was just reading about Amazon has come out with a tool that's going to make it very, very easy to take a PDF document, for example, and convert it into a true and referenced Amazon doc with all of the great word lookup and hyperlink links that you could ask for, and your X-ray feature can be turned on and all this good stuff. So that may make some of this a little bit easier.
From your lips to God's ears, Chief.
Yeah, I mean, would that not be cool just to say, here's my book, run this program, and now it's on Amazon, and you're done. And of course,
at the very least, you can now go spot check it, but you didn't have to go do all the manual lifting, because I've written macros in my time, or I've seen conversion files before, and they get you like 90% of the way there, but there's always something weird, like, why are my footnotes now in 27-point font?
Yep, yep. Well, and footnotes is a whole other, ball of wax there, too. Dealing with that on the electronic format does not always work out well. That seems to be one of the most difficult to implement features. And if you're reading something by, say Pratchett, who just lives in the footnotes, it can be very confusing and complicated trying to get back to where you started from the footnotes, especially when the footnotes themselves are footnoted, which which Pratchett does with a great frequency. So
yes, he is actively trolling formatting editors. That's sort of his own personal level of amusement, which I admire greatly.
Yes, yes, exactly. And he's one of the authors that honestly, and there's not many of them out there, but he is one author which I will actually go out of my way to get a paper copy of that book and read it instead of trying to screw around with the Kindle version of it just because of that. So if that was his point or intent. Yeah, he wins, he succeeded for sure.
Well, you know, he has always been someone who has balked at convention. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, it's true. Now but interestingly, he's not like surprisingly like Ray Bradbury, who actively and vocally and vehemently is like, you know, technology is bad, ebooks are terrible, never ever will any of my print go onto a computer screen. You know, he's not like that. He just relishes the traditional ways of reading and writing and of processing information, and doesn't see a lot of value to the new stuff. But isn't actively against it. So that at least that can be said for him.
Yes, that is true. It bothered me towards the end of Bradbury's life how much of a Luddite he turned out to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he actually went, so you know, you sort of are against the loss of knowledge. No, knowledge is lost all the time. I'm against the loss of books. That's really, you know, degrades my reading of Fahrenheit 451. I'm sorry to hear that. That was all. I just hate television. Okay, so it's not about censorship or mind, you know, control of information or the shaping of society through its consumption of ideas. No, I don't like television.
Yep.
No. Thanks, Ray. That's great.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and it's interesting too. I mean, you do read then some of his stuff, and it puts it in a little bit of a different light. But it's tough. It's tough. I'm not sure what happened. I do feel like things changed for him. You know, even the earlier ones, of course I'm not going to recall the names of the actual stories, but you know, the one about the robot maid or housekeeper and the family, it was turned into an early Twilight Zone, or the Fahrenheit 451, or any of these that really dealt very specifically with technology and the intrusion of technology into life, or with knowledge and the way that we share and use information, and then you put that in context of those later statements, and they just don't add up. They don't make sense. So I don't know if we're interpreting those early works wrong, or if he really just something changed for him.
Well, he's always been something of a Luddite in that, like, he didn't like flying. Like, it was a big deal the first time he flew in an airplane. Like, I think like Pan Am, like, was the first airplane to fly him, and they made a big deal out of it, and so on and so forth. So I don't think he was ever entirely comfortable with technology. He dealt with technology a lot in his stories, but they tended to be cautionary tales.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was ever totally comfortable with how it changed things. Although I do find it hilarious that he was not super fond of television and movies, or so he claimed later in life, considering that he made at least a big chunk of his living as a screenwriter for both television and movies.
Yes.
I mean, the Houston version of Moby Dick, the screenplay was by Ray Bradbury.
Oh, well, I didn't know that. Now, and many of his own works, of course, were turned into television plays or movies as well. Of course, Fahrenheit 451 being one of the more famous ones, but The Illustrated Man, and many of these. I guess there is a bit of a theme of that fear or paranoia. Even his really nostalgic feeling sort of books like Dandelion Wine, you know, where does evil come to the town? It comes in on technology. It comes in on a train, coming into this really idyllic town that has so little technology. The kids talk to each other through tin cans and a string. You know, that's how they communicate between the houses. So yeah, you know, I'm going to have to go back, and I'm going to have to reevaluate some of his stuff. I haven't read anything by him for a very long time, but it certainly made a huge impression on me, all of his writings when I was younger, and is one of my icons. It really is. So
Oh, I'm a great admirer myself. I actually got to see him, God, it's been 13 years ago now, at Comic-Con of all places, where he was interviewed by Julia Schwartz, the late editor emeritus of DC Comics, who used to be his literary agent. And it was basically 45 minutes of Julius just asking him to admit to all the cool stuff he had done. And there was a lot of cool stuff that he had done, but that's how I learned about the screenplay that he wrote for John Huston and the role he played in the creation of Disneyland. He and Walt Disney were friends, which, again, it's weird to me that he was not fond of movies and television necessarily, or at least television, because Disney was big on TV and he did stuff for Disney television, the wide world of Disney. But he and Disney went to a carnival in Santa Monica in the early 50s with their kids, and it was a terrible experience. They both hated it. And Walt walked away saying, you ought to write a story about an evil carnival, because I think we just went to one. And Ray said, well, you ought to take all that Mickey Mouse money and make a carnival that's worth going to, which was basically Something Wicked This Way Comes in Disneyland came out of that conversation.
Absolutely. Oh, I am so envious. That is so cool to have been able to be present and see that and hear things coming from him like that. Those stories that just they're not written down anywhere. You know, that's the only way that you ever get them, that you ever hear them.
That's right. I wish you could have reversed it and had Ray also ask Julius Schwartz, because I'm a big comic book nerd, and Julius Schwartz basically invented the Silver Age. Mm. You know, he's the guy that turned Green Lantern in from a guy in a red shirt, that had a mystical lantern from a genie, into a space cop. He's the guy that turned the Flash from a guy who with a metal helmet into the red hooded guy that did flash facts. You know, he rebooted all of these characters in the 50s in a very sci-fi way, which saved a lot of them and really created the Silver Age of comics, which then laid the way for Marvel Comics to even happen. If they don't do that to DC Comics, then Kirby and Lee don't go do Fantastic Four for Marvel and launch the Marvel Universe. So he's sort of the paterfamilias, the originator of basically comics as we know them today.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, and I imagine there's got to be an environment where that exact thing is happening, where, you know, people are picking his brain for for some of that, either that or hopefully he'll write it down himself, so it won't be lost, some of these stories and how things were brought together. It it seems to be a good time for that sort of thing to be happening again. You know, Michael Chabon and his book, oh gosh, and of course I'm not going to remember the name of it. I read it.
Cavalier and Clay.
Yes. Or I kept pronouncing it in my head, Cavalier and Clay. But I don't know. It's a fantastic book for anybody that even if you're not a lover of comic books, it's just a fantastic book anyways, and it'll make you love comics, and it'll make you realize and understand, not only the joy of it and the beauty of it, but also too the pain and the struggle and how much went into these artists and their lives and how little they got for it many, many, many times. And just really a neat, a wonderful book. I've heard somewhere that they're like making that into a musical or something crazy.
I've heard a bunch of rumors about that book, and to me, that book is going to be extremely hard to do as anything other than like a television miniseries, because it is so layered. There's so much going on, and it covers so much time.
Yeah,
I don't see how you could do it as anything but like as a TV miniseries.
Well,
if you try to do it a 2-hour movie, you're just going to leave 90% of it out, and it's not. The whole point of the Chabon work is it builds and builds and builds upon itself. Yeah. So I don't know how they would do it as anything but that.
Well, and they're doing American Gods by Neil Gaiman. You know, so if you can do that, Cavalier and Clay. Okay,
it can be done. It doesn't mean it can be done well.
Well, yeah.
yes, they're doing American Gods supposedly as a TV series, which I'm really interested to see.
Yeah, I'm interested and frightened both at the same time, because that is yeah. I think at this point anyways, and I have to confess, I haven't read a lot of Neil's the comics that he's done and his graphic novels, but for the works of prose that I've read of his, I find that really to be the top of his form was American Gods. I just thought it was absolutely fantastic.
Well, I think both of us then need to go read Good Omens, which is where he teamed up with Pratchett.
Oh, yeah,
to
okay.
Write a book.
You're right. You know, well, okay. So I love that book, but that's just a different class of book entirely. It's got so much of Pratchett's humor in it, and but Gaiman's sort of dark exploration of individualized character that it's just its own thing. You almost just can't say that's a Gaiman book or a Pratchett book. They did a brilliant job of working together. That's one of the few books. I do not read many things more than once, and that is one of the very few books that I've read not just once, I've read it three times. I've loved it that much. So yeah, if you have not read that, you absolutely need to pick that book up and devour it. It'll take you about 3 hours, and you'll be you'll be done.
Good to know. I will go. I'm adding that to my Goodreads to be read list right now.
Yeah, and that's another one. I hear they're going to be making some sort of screen adaptation for, or was it going to be a screen adaptation, or maybe it was a graphic novel they were going to create out of that. One or the other. I can't recall, but definitely
probably a graphic novel, I would bet.
read the prose before you see the screen version or the graphic novel version. I would say make sure. Make sure and get that. Oh man, you know. I have to bring us around back. I'm going to throw out though, in case you do get snow, I'm going to throw out one of our cool sites of the week here because we were talking about snow earlier. So I'm totally shifting topics here on everything. If anybody feels derailed right now, there's a good reason for it. It's because I just completely took the train off the tracks. There is a cool app I wanted people to know about. I have not tried this myself. I do not take any responsibility for your experience with this app. But if you get a lot of snow this weekend, as many of us probably will, and you don't know what to do about it, there's a new app. It's like Uber, but for snow. And it's called Plows with a Z, Plowz. And you can actually, their website is, it's like Plows and Mows or Mows and Plows. I guess they do mowing in the summer too. But you go in, you just put in your address, and just like with Uber, you can select a time and get a rate for how much it's going to cost you to get your driveway plowed, and they'll come and they'll do it, and you can do it all through the app. You never have to talk to a live person or talk to anybody at all if you don't want to, and you just look out your window and see that your driveway is plowed. So just gonna throw that out. Would you use an app like that, Jay? Is that something that would appeal to you for any reason?
In the once every 3 years we get enough snow that it's necessary here, I would probably use that app, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see myself doing it too. You know, especially, of course, the problem is going to be if we do get the amount of snow that they're predicting, just like Uber, I'm sure that rate just cranks up, you know, and you're paying, you know, double, triple. But of course, that's when you're going to use it. So I don't know how you balance it. Well, we'll see. I'm going to at least this weekend look online there and see how they break out the charges, and if there's a difference between getting your snow plowed Sunday night versus Monday morning versus Monday afternoon. You know, and I would expect that your Monday afternoon plow charge would be significantly lower than that late Sunday night, early Monday morning plow. But we'll see. So we should also, too, of course, close out our geek trivia from last week, which was about also about large numbers of people. It had to do with what the most watched TV show that was not the Super Bowl, and that was, which is of course coming up very, very soon here this next weekend, but it was also not the last episode of MASH.
Right. So what was the television program that there have only been two television programs that were not Super Bowls that generated an audience of at least 100 million people? One of them was the last episode of MASH, which got about 121 million people. Mm. And the other one that pulled it off was the final episode of Roots, which got almost exactly 100 million people when it broadcast on the end of January 1977. So basically 38 years ago yesterday.
Wow.
But here's the insane thing about both of those. So 51% of the households in the United States watched the end of Roots. 60% watched the last episode of MASH. Both of them cleared 70% of the television audience. You will never, ever see those numbers again. So, you know, when you talk about the Super Bowl, and they're going to advertise it all day today, it's going to be the most watched Super Bowl ever. What they mean by that is more human beings are going to watch the Super Bowl than any other Super Bowl or any other program. But that's because, A, there are more people, and B, there are more TVs.
Mm-hmm.
What you will never get again is any program that ever clears even, I would think, 50% of the total available viewing audience. No one's going to get share numbers like that ever again.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. Especially the way that we now time shift everything, you know, and live sports are one of the few things that you can't easily time shift and still get the same amount of enjoyment out of it. But boy, you know, when that first episode of season 5 of the Game of Thrones hits the wires, I expect that'll bring HBO now down, or HBO Go down to its knees again, and will very, very quickly become the most downloaded episode of anything ever. And that's like, I guess that's the new metric, is how many people are stealing your stuff.
Yeah,
that's how you know how successful you are.
What is the pirate success?
Yes, exactly. So what should we be thinking about for next week?
Well, going on 8 years ago this week, Mark Zuckerberg founded Facebook. So we're going to do a little Facebook question. For any of you who have seen The Social Network, the movie, you know that Zuckerberg sort of got the whole Facebook thing going by stealing photos from the virtual Facebooks of different dorms at Harvard and then putting them together in an app called FaceMash, where you could vote hot or not based on those photos.
Yep.
And he almost got kicked out of school for that.
Rightfully so.
And then, yeah, rightfully so. So that was his first application. The third major application he wrote was version 1.0 of Facebook, but he famously wrote something in between using the same basic code. So what application did Mark Zuckerberg write between FaceSmash and Facebook using the same basic Facebook code?
Oh, that's a great question. I have no clue. I know Bill Gates is very envious of his ability to speak Chinese, that he learned Chinese. But I do not know that. That's a great question. And man, 8 years, just 8 years since that's been around. It's tough talking to people now, kids especially, who, you know, everybody's on the Facebook. That's what it comes down to. So, but of course now the teenagers are finding new ways to communicate to keep their old man out. But that's
put a lot more stuff on Twitter these days than I put on Facebook, because my mom's on Facebook. And it's not that there's anything I'm embarrassed about. There's just stuff I don't want to explain. What was that thing with the red shirt and the dead people? It's a Star Trek joke, Mom. Really? I don't remember that episode. I'm not going into this with you, Mom.
See, now it's
not worth the trouble.
It's interesting.
Doing all the heavy lifting and explaining red shirt jokes to you.
See, now it's interesting, though, that you say that, because I almost go the other direction. I find it easier for me to manage my privacy controls on Facebook than I do on Twitter. So Twitter I tend to use as a little bit more of a public forum, whereas my Facebook is more of just between my friends, and I, you know, let loose and, you know, go ballistic on people that I think are being dumb and, you know, and stuff like that. Much, much more so than I do on Twitter, where I'm a little more aware that it's a really, truly public forum. But again, topic for another day. Unfortunately, I got Rob Schott, or not unfortunately, but for good, we've got Rob Schott first, Robbie Rigel on deck, ready to go and to put some science in your ears. Jay, thank you for, as always, listening to me babble about, you know, my nostalgia about books and things, and then and the great geek trivia stuff. And man, stay warm, stay safe. Have a great week.
Back at you, and enjoy your Super Bowl weekend, Chief.
All right, you too. Take care. Thanks, Jay. Jay Garman, jgarman.net. You can find out a lot more stuff about him. Next week, we got Joe Otto coming on from Verizon. Don't forget about that. You are listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. I wasn't lying about Rob Schott first. He's got a lot of science. He's got a big cup. It's going to pour right into your ears. It's going to come immediately after this. I'm going to play for you something I don't understand. I have no idea what it means. It's in Khmer. So enjoy it. I love the tune though. It's off of the It's off of the album Cannibal Courtship. The artist is called Dengue Fever. The song is Uku, and enjoy it. It's a little something different. And then stay tuned, of course, as I said, for Robbie Rigel and Rob Schott First. Have a great week, everyone. Thanks for listening, and stay safe, stay warm. Don't drive if you don't have to, but have a good one. And this is Uku by Dengue Fever.